Today's episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you, in part, by Feels. Sponsors like Feels help me keep the lights on here at The Blotter Presents, so please keep an ear out for that URL and sponsor code later in the episode. And that episode starts right now.
I was stunned. I mean, I just thought, now we're talking three people. And these women didn't know each other. How many more could there be?
Netflix's Athlete A isn't just another litany of the abuses suffered by the athletes of USA Gymnastics at the hands of Larry Nassar. It's an indictment of the Carollis, Steve Penny, and everyone else who put wholesome brand image ahead of protecting children. But if you've already watched At the Heart of Gold, is this one, quote, necessary? The episode of American Greed we're discussing in the cold case section might be necessary if you're looking to understand how Recession Realty ties into credit card fraud, or why Stacey Keach is in the True Crime Voiceover Hall of Fame. Predatory physical therapy and predatory lending. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 150. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that looks at how true crime is told and sold. Episode 150. I am glad that we are spending it with returning guest Stephanie Early Green. Welcome back, Stephanie.
Thanks, Sarah.
I'm less glad that we're talking about Larry fucking Nassar again, but that is the gig in these parts and for our most wanted section. Content warning, this is the Nassar case, so of course, slash alas, discussions of sexual abuse of children and the sheer volume of cases may be overwhelming as well, so listen with care, as always. Here's the case file from Wikipedia. Athlete A, quote, follows a team of investigative journalists from the Indianapolis Star as they broke the story of Dr. Larry Nassar assaulting young female gymnasts. The movie was released on June 24, 2020 by Netflix, end quote. This is a couple of months after its planned premiere at Tribeca in April was canceled for obvious reasons. So I think you and I together have watched pretty much all of the, of the pertinent Nassar material. How did you feel about this one generally, and then specifically compared to other properties that we've talked about the case?
So I enjoyed it. I think that the unique angle of this one is the institutional angle. It tries to give some more color about the kind of machinations of USAG to cover up Nassar's abuse. That said, we can talk about this more, but I wish they had gone even deeper into that. But you know, it's well done. It's compelling. I don't want to say enjoyed, but I was engaged with it.
Yes. there's always that, problem with which verbs to use.
Like, you know,
this was good, but did I like it? Yeah, I know what you mean.
Like, anything about Nassar is always going to be kind of stomach turning to sit through, but this was well done. There is a lot of overlap with, now I'm mixed, like, it's hard for me to remember what was in the podcast and what was in At the Heart of Gold or whatever
same.
The documentary was called. But I think those two properties focused more on the way Nassar abused people, like the way he got away with it.
Yeah.
And victim testimony. And there is some of that in this, but this was more about sort of the institutional support that Nassar received and also the way institutions dealt with victims. So it's both the way that USAG enabled Larry Nassar to do it and also then the way that they tried to shut down victims who came forward. So that's how I differentiate it. I don't know if you agree.
I think so. I think that the using the in of following the reporters at the Indianapolis Star, which like I did sort of find it annoying that they're like, and this story came out of the sticks. Like Indianapolis is probably the only city most people can name in Indiana. I'm not sure that that's the sticks, but I mean, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a good way into it. I think that sometimes that, or that angle on storytelling, like the spotlight angle, I guess you could call it, doesn't always work to sort of be over the shoulders of the reporters, but I thought this was a good place to start it. Mm-hmm. And I thought that they got good access to both survivors and the reporters and various commentators and attorneys who were all quite sugar-free. Rachel Denhollander, I just think is great. She has this... determination to her, and even as she's saying about how she's like, oh yeah, I wasn't even that good a gymnast, but that's not the fucking point, like no, it really isn't, you're right. And she is just willing to do every documentary and every podcast about this to just make sure that it, like, she's creating a perimeter, which I think is amazing.
Same.
But this did definitely try to get more into USAG, into the sort of cultural, not halo on Bella Caroli, but I mean, I guess that, and how he was like basically a queen maker in the sport, and also the transition of the sport away from women, grown-ups with some agency within it, to very tiny achievers who are a little less able to act on their own behalf and whose, you know, brains haven't finished forming yet. So here's clip two, which talks about the rise of Nadia and then the smaller, younger gymnast and the effects of that.
If you look back at teams from the 50s and the 60s, they look like grown women. They are grown women. But that started to change in the late 60s, but really solidified in 1976 when Nadia won the Olympics as a 14-year-old. And there was just this mad rush of little girls that wanted to do gymnastics because we related to her. And what emerged was an aesthetic that was very, very young, childlike. And so it created a really dangerous environment because eating disorders became very prevalent, you know, delaying menstruation and delaying maturation. But I think people really believed that for the more difficult skills to be performed, you had to be tiny. There's also the benefit of the coaches having more control when the girls are younger.
Yeah. That's, mm-hmm. You know, I love that she sort of phrases that as an oh, by the way, but I think that really is her central point, that this environment where you're dealing with girls and not women then creates a whole bunch of other problems and the failure to act in loco parentis, et cetera.
Yeah. And she, well, not just she, not just that author, but the documentary ties in the whole Romanian, like, total control model that was imported along with Bella Caroli from Romania, like the Ceausescu, is that dictator's name, system, like, where those children were, you know, tools of the state, basically. And then they just imported that entire system of control over to the U.S. gymnastics scene because they thought that would lead to more victories.
Yeah. And, you know, apparently they weren't wrong. So this no. institution is sort of like, well, but it gets results.
Yeah.
Which, but these are also 12-year-olds. Anyway, the part that I wish they had leaned on more, especially in terms of contemporary footage of, like, showing these gymnasts, like, drinking Coca-Cola, and, mm-hmm. you know, turning on a lamp at Target or whatever the ads that they were using. The fact that Steve Penny was like a marketing guy who came up through the ranks of USA Gymnastics and was primarily concerned with getting and maintaining its sponsorship opportunities.
Wasn't he with the U.S. like Cycling Association before he came to USAG? I'm like, yeah, well, that tracks.
Yeah, like you're really on a roll there, Penny. Yeah. But here is, I believe, one of the victim's attorneys or one of the like class action attorneys talking about Steve Penny's priorities, which were not the athlete. It's clip three.
So it had an organization that was run by a sports marketing expert. And that's what he cared about. He cared about marketing this brand.
This is the image of Bella Caroli that the world has grown accustomed to seeing. The intense, relentless coach who now turns out championship gymnasts for the United States.
You know, these children are all being advised by adults as to how they can realize their Olympic dream. So you're basically using that child's dream to build this brand. And they were so busy trying to sell that brand that they didn't have time for those girls.
And I think that you have two, well, more than two probably, but you have a couple of three things going on here. There's the fact that the brand is considered more important than the athletes who create it. There's the fact that these athletes are, and there's the fact that the athletes are minor children. So, like, the opportunities for exploitation are myriad. And while it does seem like in, like, under the old Romanian or Soviet system, that's something that athletes would be not accustomed to, but like they wouldn't expect to take part in the bounty that results from their success. But here, like, shouldn't trustees be elected? Like, why aren't the parents involved? Who sends their 12-year-old to Texas to live in an unair-conditioned bunker for however many months? Like, there's so many questions here about who thinks this is okay that the mind boggles. But the branding angle in particular, I wanted to know more just about the numbers and the properties involved.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to your earlier point about like who sends their kids to a bunker, I mean, I think there's a certain amount of kind of Olympic dream groupthink that happens where you're told, well, this is the way that it must be done. And the parents are like, okay. And they just go with it, which isn't to say that the parents, like, for example, Maggie Nichols' parents weren't concerned and tried to do take action when they found out she'd been assaulted.
Sure.
But then that's when the institution steps in and sort of overwhelms whatever internal efforts happen to, like, you know, weed bad people out.
Well, yeah, I guess I should say, like, I'm not trying to blame the parents. I think generally the parents try to be involved. But as with all of these situations, like, there is a certain amount of pattern recognition that like just closes up any gaps in what is normal and appropriate, because most people don't expect to be for their children to be abused or violated in this manner. See also Nasser abusing girls with the mom in the room.
Yeah. Yep.
Which that always still gets to me, like, these women just saying, like, well, you know, my mom was there and I thought she could see and that it was okay with her. Like, oh my God, how fucking so heartbreaking awful. For both of them. That's so shitty.
It's so awful.
But actually, our next clip gets into how, particularly for the athletes, they have been conditioned for such a long time to not believe their own instincts and not believe their own, like, physical sensations and nerve endings. And that, like, the environment that Larry Nasser flourished in was, like, not that he wasn't eminently capable of, like, creating these situations and preying on these girls, but he almost didn't have to set up these situations because all of USA Gymnastics had already like done a lot of the work for him in that regard. And clip four talks a little bit more about why or about how that happens. And this is primarily in this segment, author Jennifer Say, who was an Olympian in 1996, I think, 2000.
I don't remember.
Yeah, she's a really good talking head, and I kind of wanted to get her.
Is she the one who wrote Chalked Up?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So here she is just talking about how the gaslighting has been going on for so long that by the time they see someone like Nasser, he doesn't have to work very hard to do what he does.
You know, in other sports, the athletes are adults. They can reasonably make choices about what they want. I don't think that is true in gymnastics. You know, these kids go to these national training centers when they're 10 years old. They are abused and mistreated for years. So even by the time they're of age, the line between tough coaching and child abuse gets blurred. So then when real, like, obvious abuse, sexual abuse happens, you already don't believe your own take on things because you think you're hungry. You think your ankle hurts. You think that you're working really hard. But you're told and you're screamed at that you're lazy and you're fat and there's nothing wrong with your ankle. So when a man puts his ungloved hand into your vagina without asking you, I can only imagine that what you feel is, he's this great doctor and I'm lucky to be here, so I'm not going to say anything.
Yeah. I mean, this film is not a fun sit, but if it does nothing else, like making that point explicit in all the senses of that word, is really good and important, I think, that by the time these young women get to this point, they've been conditioned by the entire situation not to talk back about anything.
Yeah, it's like the physical and emotional abuse primes them for other types of abuse. It all feeds into, system.
Yeah, and I thought that was a really good encapsulation of a number of sort of systemic problems in sport at various levels, like, I don't know, college basketball. And, you know, not to get off on my hashtag play the players rant, everyone's heard it a million times before on many different podcasts, but there's a level of abuse that I think D1 athletes tolerate because that's the only way, like the only way forward is through that. So if Coach K is being horribly verbally and or physically abusive to his starting five, it's just like, well, this is what you have to do to have gone to Duke and get drafted and go to the NBA.
Yeah.
And what I think a lot of athletes have been on the athlete track for long enough in their lives that they may not have the sort of not critical thinking, but do you know what I mean? Like they're,
yeah, well, it's like, I don't know, they're just, like you said, they're conditioned for it.
Yeah.
And there's probably, they believe, a direct correlation between listening to their coaches and success.
Yeah.
So, you know, talking back or pushing back at all, they don't want to risk, you know, A, pissing off their abuser, but B,
right,
paying the price in some sort of, you know, like their performance is going to suffer. Because they've been told that if they don't do exactly what they're told and don't push through pain or whatever, then they're not going to succeed. So I think there's a lot of stuff going on that keep them in that prison, you know?
Sure. And particularly, you know, for athletes of color, but also women and girls athletes, I think it's, you know, tremendously difficult because, first of all, I don't have any clips regarding this because, frankly, it was just a little too depressing. But like the victim blaming and doxing that happened after the story broke of victims was crazy. But then Maggie Nichols is basically being like Title IX violationed for speaking up.
Like, I didn't know about that. Did you?
What? That she was that she had spoken up.
Shut out of the Olympic team after she accused him. I don't think that was mentioned as explicitly in any of the other properties we examined, you know?
Yeah, I don't think it was either. And I think she was not as much of a focus in the other ones, which might be why, but it does seem like that should have played a larger role, because that did seem like new information.
Yeah.
Here. So there was that. And on top of that, all these institutions are like, oh, no, we got it. Don't say anything to anyone. You don't want to ruin the FBI investigation. And then, of course, they don't report, even though it's mandatory. And that's the final clip that we have for this section, which is a little bit long, but I left it exactly as Stephanie called for it, because I think this is the other thing that sets this property apart from the other ones about Larry Nassar and every, you know, the entire generation of gymnasts that he abused, is that there were continuing cascading failures after that, and multiple attempts to report him and stop him were stymied by institutions. So here's clip 5.
So when Jamie, Rachel, and Jessica reported Nassar's abuse to the Indy Star in 2016, that was the first time it was reported to the public. This wasn't the first time USAG heard about Nassar's abuse. They knew in June of 2015, when Maggie Nichols tells her coach that Larry Nassar's touching me funny, who then should have reported to the police, but she didn't. She reports it to Ron DeFane, who should have reported the police, but she didn't, who then reports it to Steve Penny, who should have reported the police, but he didn't. And their lawyers had them hire somebody who investigates sexual harassment cases at workplaces. And she interviewed Maggie Nichols, and then she interviewed Olympians Allie Raisman and Michaela Maroney. Allie Raisman reported that Dr. Nassar sexually abused Michaela in their residence at the Olympic Village in London in 2012. It was 5 weeks between the time Maggie reported to USAG and when Mr. Penny finally told the FBI. That's a direct violation of Indiana and Texas law. But then, for some reason, the FBI took no action. Nothing happened in October, in November, in December, in January, February, March, April, May. All this time, Nassar is working at Michigan State. He's molesting girls that entire time. 13 months.
I just don't get it. Like, it brings me back to when everything was coming down with Jerry Sandusky in Penn State. Mm-hmm. Like, even if you're wrong, just like drop a dome over this person just in case. What is fucking wrong with you?
Yeah. But their priority wasn't actually protecting kids, right? Their priority was, I guess, protecting themselves. But even if you're trying to protect yourself, I guess maybe their thinking was if they stop him working, it shows admission of guilt on their part. I don't even know what the rationale is.
Yeah, or that I think this was mentioned sort of not in the clip that I played, but in that section where they're talking about the branding, is that it became that, like, the idea of gymnastics became this like wholesome sport for kids. The other issue with Nassar is that this was not when they finally got enough to take him down. I think this was not the first or even the second time that complaints had been filed and that he had wriggled out of it. And I can imagine someone at USAG thinking, like, well, now it's been going on for a while, like long enough that if they get him for this, Like it, now it's been going on for 5 years and we have heard these complaints before and it really looks bad. Not just that we didn't do anything about this, but that we didn't do anything about all the other times.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can't really say what the logic is. I'd escort this person to the end of a pier and be like, don't move until we figure this out. But everyone's
letters and complete apathy. I have no idea. I mean, that's what I wanted more from this documentary, in that sense. Like, I wanted more information on the internal processes as far as they've been investigated at USAG. And I wanted more information about how USAG got the way it is. I mean, yeah, we know Steve Penny was a marketing guy and he changed the way the priorities of, you know, US gymnastics and what they should be focusing on or what they did focus on in terms of branding. But I wanted to know how the organization went so rotten.
Yeah.
Like, you know, institutions tend to go rotten, but I wanted to know the unique story of this one. And I don't think we totally got that. Like, was, you know, when did it start going bad? Cause you know, we don't know. Was it when the Romanians came over? Is that when, abuse started being tolerated more or what? I just wanted more of that story, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good point because I mean, if you, it sort of reminds me of, these periodic exposés of, Quibi and how terrible and dumb and wasteful it is over there and Fyre Festival-y and
oh my god,
revelation that Meg Whitman, who I guess is the CEO or the COO, like that she doesn't really watch TV. And oh, it's god. Like, well, I mean, enjoy the paycheck, I guess. It's not my money, but on the other hand, what, like, are you insane, Quibi? Like, get someone, not that Katzenberg is any better as it turns out, but it's like, why? I understand why, but then create a CMO position and have Steve Penny do that, and then have maybe someone who has been a coach or been around the sport in some way other than selling it be the head of it. I understand that former athletes maybe aren't also good executives, but maybe they are.
Well, some might be. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just wanted, I was curious about that particular institution and, that's one way I felt the documentary needed to be fleshed out a little bit more. I wish it was just like half an hour longer and it was just about USAG. But
yeah,
cause I'm sure there are other stories, not just about Larry Nassar. I'm sure there are other stories about this institution, like fucking athletes over. And I kind of want to hear those stories.
Well, and I feel like I've seen long reads that weren't even that recent, but were like surfaced by people talking about this case about like the, you know, dark underbelly of the Caroli system and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I guess what I really want from this is like either a follow-up in like a year just about USAG and what's going on over there and whether some of these people are still working in the industry or have gone to jail or what the deal is. But, you know, even a frontline following up that's like, where are they now?
Yeah.
Because I mean, I think that another problem here is that there will be this spasm of righteous indignation about an issue. And then people, especially in 2020, think about something else.
Yeah.
So I would like the culture to come back to this and not forget about it. But yeah, this was good. It, like half an hour in, I was like, I don't know if this is different enough, but then it really started unfolding some different angles on the story. So yeah, I'd recommend it.
Same.
Before we get to our cold case, it's time for a word from our sponsor. It's 2020, still, somehow, so a question during an ad spot about whether you experience stress, anxiety, or trouble sleeping is probably strictly rhetorical. But whether you're struggling with one of those, some combination, or all three with a side of chronic pain, Feels, with an A, is a better way to feel better. Feels' premium CBD will keep your head clear and help you feel your best. CBD has been proven to reduce anxiety, pain, and sleeplessness. And while I'm a ball of anxiety even on the average day, we haven't had a lot of average days lately, let's face it. It's been harder than usual to focus during these extraordinary times, but Feels has helped me do less staring at the ceiling, less worrying about worrying, and more getting done what I need to do. The world of CBD might seem a little intimidating if you're new to it, but Feels helps you do less worrying about that, too. Feels can help simplify the process with a CBD hotline offering real human support. Where to start, how to find the best dosage for you, and wherever you end up in that discovery process, Feels is a cinch to take. Just place a few drops under your tongue and you'll feel the difference in minutes. That's it. Feels works naturally. You won't feel any high or hangover, and you won't get addicted. And Feels' hassle-free membership program is a cinch as well. Feels is shipped direct to your doorstep every month. Members save money on every order, and you can pause or cancel anytime you like. Feels has me feeling my best every day, and it can help you too. Become a member today and get 50% off your first order with free shipping. Head to feels.com/blotter. That's feals.com/blotter, B-L-O-T-T-E-R, to become a member and get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. Feels.com/blotter. Thanks, Feels. And no thanks to you, Next Door Construction. Sorry about that in advance, listeners. There's some like farty sounding drilling going on, but we will try to forge ahead with the cold case. So in the cold case today, we are talking about American Greed, Season 13, Episode 6, The House Flipping Reality Star Fraudster. Leaving aside the fact that I thought American Greed just started like 2 years ago. I had no idea there were this many episodes. Here's the case file adapted from Dearly.com. Quote, Scott Meneged embezzled more than $34 million from his moneylender by submitting loans for properties he didn't own. Of the 2,712 loans applications he submitted to the company, only 96 were legitimate. Additionally, Meneged stole the identities of deceased customers at his Furniture King store in Phoenix to open up new lines of credit. End quote. Thank you, Angie McPherson, for that summary. Aggressive auctioned property flipper Meneged was on Property Wars, then found himself on a 2019 episode of American Greed that we picked because we thought it would be a bit lighter fare than Athlete A. Here's another content warning. This one for a mention of suicide. Again, and as always, listen with care for yourselves. Okay. Had you ever heard of this guy before, Stephanie?
Nope.
Do you ever want to talk about him again?
No.
did you feel like this was a good overview of the case and of frauds like this case?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'll be honest, like, maybe it's just 2020 warping my brain, but I watched this with my husband and I had to keep pausing it and being like, what did they just say? Can you explain it to me? Like, I'm not that dumb, but I was confused with some of the ins and outs of this, but I mean, I got the gist. So yes, I guess it was a good overview.
I thought it had some bits that were very good at explaining how certain frauds work, which I enjoyed. Right. And I also enjoyed, I always forget the narrator of this is Stacy Keach, who is really having quite a fine time at his job. but there were also parts that I felt like they could have gotten into more. At the top of the show, they're talking about Meneged's, like, I guess, legitimate business, but basically when the bottom fell out of the economy the last time in 2008-2009, property flippers would come in and buy these things up at foreclosure auction, like on the courthouse steps. So here is one of his co-stars explaining how that works in clip 6.
What the lenders did, because nobody would buy these, they wound up discounting the notes substantially to make it so that people at the courthouse steps would buy them so banks wouldn't have to take them in as inventory. And so we would go down and bid on them.
The massive number of properties, quick turnaround, and daily bidding wars between potential buyers makes for a ripe reality TV show.
I mean, it's not one that I would ever watch because Scott is like this sort of classic Ed Hardy shirt wearing contrast stitch back pocket dungaree sporting blob. That actually my current neighborhood is kind of full of. That's
oh boy.
But I thought that was a good sort of place to start from. And then he's repeatedly described as aggressive in a way that, you know, doesn't mean assertive. It means aggressive. Like one sense is that he threatened people.
Yeah.
But then some cracks in the facade start to show. One of his colleagues was like the only one who sort of figured out what this guy was about. Scott Welsh on a $100 bet with this dude. And this dude was like, yeah, I don't need to work with you anymore because in for a penny, as it were. Here's clip 7.
I'm like, excuse me, I understand that you didn't hike Camelback and you stole $100 from me. And he goes, no, I paid you on one of the deals. And I'm like, no, I don't think you did. I'm like, which property? He goes, oh, I can't remember. Therefore, I said, we're done. Get out of my office, pack your crap, we're done. I said, we run way too much money in and out of these accounts, anywhere from $12, $15, $16 million a month. If you're willing to steal $100 from me, you're willing to steal $100,000.
I kind of wanted this guy to have a podcast. Yeah. It's just like a weekly 12 to 15 minutes of him being like, all right, so here's the situation. And he describes some like nightmare deal. I mean, I'm married to a realtor, so I have a higher tolerance for these stories than some people might. But I thought he had he gave good talking head, and I thought he would be an interesting guy to have his own pocket podcast.
Yeah, totally.
But then it starts to go real bad. We meet this CPA, Tony Burdett, I believe his name is. We're told about how he and his wife had scrimped and saved and been frugal, and that they're
always those people who decide to like save all their money their whole lives and then like invest in a pyramid scheme, you know?
Yeah, in the friend of a friend's parents. Sons, you know, thank you, Simone. And he's like, well, I'm a CPA and I checked it over and it looked legit. I'm like, well, remind me not to have you do my taxes, sir.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's buku foreshadowing that they're going to lose everything. And they'd already taken a pretty big hit on their portfolio. But so Scott is using this cash lender. He's like colleagues with this cash lender, Denny. And Denny also has investors that, you know, create the cash for his business, I guess. So he's got solid returns, and Burdett decides to invest. But a little voice in Burdett's head told him it wasn't the best idea. Clip 8.
And I looked over at my wife. I said, well, I hope we don't end up on American Greed.
I mean,
oh boy.
If that's something that even joking comes out of your mouth, whatever it is, don't do it. I think that's a good rule.
You know what's funny? This tells you, well, I don't know what it tells you, but my husband and I were both like, is this that well-known a show? Like, is it? We had never watched it before. Like, I had heard of it, I guess, but I had never watched American Greed. So when we heard that guy say that, we were like, oh, like... Where have we been? Have we been living under like a rock?
I don't watching? I mean, I think you know what it is, and I'm surprised that I didn't know about the show or know that it was more of a thing because it's a CSNBC or it's a CNBC show.
Yeah.
So, and I still watch The Prophet. I'm like a season behind, but I still watch it. So, but there's like a whole CNBC-averse that.
Right. I bet my dad watches this show.
I bet my dad is also extremely familiar. Like, CNBC is on somewhere in their home all the time.
Yep.
When I worked for him right out of college, like, Ron Insana was like, I was like, oh, right, I don't actually know him personally. Like, we would talk to the anchors in the office. But there's a whole CNBC-averse that I think is well known to a certain subset of people who can give you like timelines on which sharks were on Shark Tank at what point.
Right.
That we civilians are just like, because we don't work in finance.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. I feel less bad now.
Yeah. So, but like a CPA in Texas, I have zero difficulty believing that he watches this live when it premieres each episode. So
totally.
Yeah. Sorry.
And yet he still made this bad investment.
And yet, I mean, okay, like the number of conversations my husband and I have had in front of investigation discovery shows where it's like, look, if you get sick of me, just like, we don't have to go all the way to a ravine. Just get a divorce. It's fine.
Yeah.
My favorite part of the episode was when they were explaining how Scott, once he basically had to be a one-man pyramid scheme involving Social Security fraud, that he skimmed out of the obituaries. Like, that was fascinating.
But how did he get their Social Security numbers? I don't understand that.
Thank you. They didn't say that. I was like, but what's the next? That they're like, well, they got, you know, he got their financial information and their personal identifying information. I'm like, uh-huh. How?
Yeah, I don't get that.
Like, I would actually like to see a reenactment of him, like, just cold calling someone and being like, pretending he doesn't know the last four of the social or what, like, how do you get that information? I don't.
Yeah.
Did he employ a hacker? Because here's the other thing. Three of his employees also got caught up in this and went to jail. Spoiler, everybody went to jail. But they don't really mention that because they want to. Oh, I think also his dad got indicted. Oops.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I think that's not as elegant and simple an episode, although it's like, right. I don't know, I'd rather have more information. But anyway, if you're looking to do this for yourself, here's the credit card / death fraud for dummies, but with all the relevant information missing. Clip 9.
Unless Scott Monaghan's customers need furniture in the afterlife, it appears he is simply pocketing the bank's money.
These were entirely fabricated purchases done so that Scott Monaghan could get his hands on funds quickly.
For example, Monaghan might read in the obits that an Arizona woman has died at 89. Using her personal data, he takes out a Wells Fargo line of credit in her name. He uses it to buy $5,000 worth of furniture. On paper, that is. In reality, the living room set stays right on his showroom floor. But the $5,000 goes into Monaghan's pocket.
In an attempt to legitimize the fraud, Scott Monaghan did purchase some money orders from a bank and then try to pay down that line of credit to sort of keep the fraud ongoing and not raise any flags with the bank.
I mean, that's sort of an interesting way to do it, that he's like laundering his own money through, instead of just like taking a cash advance on the card.
Yeah.
Which is what most people would probably do. He's like, well, why don't I buy my own furniture and then I can launder the money at the same time?
Dead people buying furniture.
Yeah, I mean, sure. But then they, first of all, of course, Wells Fargo is involved. Like, just shut it down, Wells Fargo. Like, you clearly are not learning how to be good at bank. Just stop.
They really do suck, yeah.
Yeah, but I do wonder how exactly or what personal data they were asking for, what his like.
Well, my only thought is that, so the narration made it seem like he was just finding random dead people in the obits, but could it be that these were customers he had on file already? And then that'd be a lot of dead customers, though.
Yeah, I'm wondering if that's not actually how they did it, because the case file that I read before made it sound like he had gone through the customer roles. So maybe what he was actually doing was cross-checking or cross-referencing customers with local obits and seeing if they had other card information on file, and then using that to open it at the same bank.
But how many customers, I guess maybe a lot of your customers are elderly, a lot of them would be dead, but depending on how much business he does, how many customers would be dead, you know?
Yeah.
Doesn't seem likely. I don't know. I need more information.
Yeah. Well, and exactly what, I mean, they said like that he was, it was egregious and there were these red flags at the bank. Like, this guy is taking the trouble of laundering his own basically stolen credit cards, then he surely would know that he has to keep whatever deposits under the RICO limit. So did he not do that? It's strange to me that they're explaining this, like this is a financial true crime show, but then they're very coy about the details because it's like they don't want the already rapacious finance bros who watch CNBC to get any ideas.
Yeah, like a do-it-yourself.
Like
furniture dead person fraud.
I mean, some of us are just interested in processy stuff. We don't necessarily want to do a heist. We just want to know how it was done.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was disappointing. It is a little bit fillery at the ad breaks. And then there's this description of the demise of this Denny guy who was the cash lender company that Scott... There's a whole backstory about how Scott accidentally, quote unquote, because he couldn't pay, ended up gutting this guy's business and screwing over all his investors, with the result that Denny took his own life. The way that this is relayed in the episode, I found highly bizarre. Here's a clip. And again, if this is something that you're sensitive to, you may want to skip ahead about a minute.
She hasn't heard from him in a couple of days, which is highly unusual.
She drove over with the boys. The boys ran to the front door. It was locked. So they ran around the side and jumped over the fence. As they ran towards the house, they saw their father hanging with a luggage strap around his neck, and he was dead. And this is something that two young boys should never have to see in their lives. And they were so frightened and afraid, they ran back and they tried to go straight through the fence. And they broke the fence, but they couldn't get through. And they jumped over and ran to their mother, and their mom called 911.
There are like half a dozen reasons just off the top of my head that you just cut that whole segment. And yet, there it is.
Yeah.
I mean, 9/11? No. We are shown while this voiceover is happening, and I believe this is the family's attorney. It's someone's attorney or an attorney, that we're shown a picture of the fence, which has a couple of slats knocked out because apparently these kids tried to like run through the fence because they were that freaked out. The B-roll of like a bird wind chime is weird. We can figure once the boys came upon him hanging from a luggage strap that he wasn't, you know, barbecuing. Like we get where this is going. We've watched true crime before. Thanks for the relish in saying that he was dead. That whole sequence is just really like, but then Scott's relative responsibility in that death isn't really explained. Like they're happy to kind of dwell on the horror of it for that family, but then they don't necessarily tie it to Scott's behavior that strongly. So I just thought that was an off choice.
Yeah. I found it disturbing because I don't want to think about two little boys finding their father dead.
No.
Obviously. But I think there needed to be more of a connection made. And I'm not sure there is a connection to be made. I mean, obviously, like, Monogat, or however you say his name, really screwed over Chittick, big time. But, I mean, I'm not sure you can lay that suicide totally at the Monogat's feet. You know what I mean?
Oh, no, I don't think you can either. And at least in terms of, like... like, legally speaking, I think it's probably quite difficult to...
Oh, and I don't even mean legally. I just mean, like, in general.
Right.
So, I'm not sure... They should have... Well, if it were me, I would have said, like, you know, related to this case, you know, Monogat was such a shit that he contributed in some way to, like, this guy's decision to kill him. I don't know. But they tried to make it all, like, dramatic and... saucy and intriguing, and I found that kind of distasteful.
Well, particularly since, I mean, you know, say that Scott is responsible for this death in part, or don't. But if you're going to bring it up and you're going to be that salacious about the presentation of this family's personal tragedy, then make the link. And if you're not going to make the link, mention it more dispassionately without a bunch of dramatical B-roll involving this out of focus pair of feet in the back of the shot.
Exactly. Yeah.
And move on, preferably to sing it with us if you know the words, how Scott got the social security numbers. We're not actually here for the blast crater that he left around to everyone's financial lives.
Right.
Like, give us the details. Yeah.
I agree.
I have watched a couple other episodes of this, and I think that it is, it's like something that if, you know, you're at your in-laws and your father-in-law is watching it, you could do a lot worse. It's like in-law TV. Like, this is fine.
Yeah, it's fine.
I am hoping to find, they had one about the New York Mafia that was like a two-parter that actually explained the fiscal relationship between corrupt police and the mafia loan sharking business. And I was like, that sounds interesting. But
yeah,
I wasn't able to find it, and I suspect they wouldn't actually be that detailed, but maybe if you don't actually need social security numbers for a scam, they'll get into the details. All right, folks. Well, that's American Greed, season 13, episode 6. It may be available on CNBC.com depending on your cable provider, or you can just tell your DVR to try to catch it. It should be rerunning at some point somewhere at like 3 a.m. That wasn't the fizzy fraud that any of us was hoping for. But Stephanie, thank you for coming back for episode 150 and for getting through American Greed with repeated pauses.
Oh, no problem.
In local news today, bees.
Stephanie, where else can people go to find you and your work and writing?
I haven't worked since March because of the pandemic, and I have 3 kids, but you can find me on my blog, StephanieEarlyGreen.com, and there are links there to all my published fiction and other work.
Fantastic. Thanks again for making the time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, the schedule is in a bit of flux at the moment, but hopefully editor and dear Spike Lee director Randy Wilkins will be here next time to talk about The Summer of Sam. Helter Skelter is finally coming out on Epix, and I'll be talking about that, as well as the Sundance Now miniseries on the disappearance of Margaret Fleming. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram, and in the Best Evidence newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. Paid subscribers get extra reviews and blotter briefs, teehee, briefs, so sign up today. Today's episode was sponsored by Feels. Please check those show notes for links, and don't forget that promo code. My guest has been Stephanie Green, and she's on Twitter at Atefi. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.